Chapter 4. As Austin stepped through the big bay door into the cavernous building at the San Diego Naval Station, his nostrils were assaulted by a hell smell emanating from the three leviathans whose floodlit carcasses were laid out on flatbed trailers. The young sailor standing just inside the door had seen the broad-shouldered man with the strange white hair approach and assumed from his commanding presence that he was an officer in mufti. When Austin went to identify himself, the sailor snapped to attention.
"Seaman coming, sir," the seaman said. "You might want to use this."
He offered Austin a surgical mask similar to the one he was wearing. "The smell has gotten real strong since they started pulling out the vital organs." Austin thanked the seaman, wondering whom he had offended to pull such foul duty, and slipped the mask over his nose. The gauze had been sprinkled with a perfumed disinfectant that didn't quite cut the strong odor but subdued the gag reflex.
"What have we got?" Austin said. "A mama, a papa, and a baby," the sailor said. "Boy, what a time we had getting them here."
The seaman wasn't exaggerating, Austin thought. The final count was 14 whales. Disposing of their bodies would have been a tall order even without the turf battles. As the first government agency to arrive on the scene, the Coast Guard was worried about hazards to navigation and planned to tow the whales out to sea and sink them with gunfire. The highly dramatic TV reports had gone around the world and stirred up animal rights activists who were angrier over the whale deaths than if Los Angeles had fallen into the Pacific Ocean with all its inhabitants. They wanted answers fast. The Environmental Protection Agency was equally curious to know what had killed mammals that were under EPA protection. The city of San Diego was horrified at the prospect of huge, smelly carcasses drifting up to its beaches, marinas, seaside hotels, and shorefront houses. The mayor called the district congressman, who happened to be on the Naval Appropriations Committee, and a compromise was reached with amazing speed. Three whales would be brought to shore for necropsy. The others would be towed out to sea and used for target practice. Greenpeace protested, but by the time they mobilized their mosquito fleet, the whales had been blasted to blubbery smithereens by Navy gunners. In the meantime, an ocean-going tug hauled the remaining whales to the base. Navy cranes lifted the massive bodies from the water in improvised slings, and they were transported to a vacant warehouse. Mammalian forensic specialists from several California universities went to work as soon as the whales were delivered. An improvised laboratory was set up. Dressed in foul-weather gear, gloves and boots, the technicians swarmed around and on top of the carcasses like large yellow insects. The head of each animal had been separated from its body, brain tissue removed and taken to the dissecting tables for tests. Wheelbarrows served the function of stainless steel trays in a human autopsy.
"Not exactly brain surgery, is it?" Austin observed, as he listened to the buzz of power saws echoing off the metal walls of the warehouse.
"No, sir," the sailor said, "and I'll be glad when it's over."
"Let's hope it's soon, sailor."
Austin pondered why he had left his comfortable hotel room for this ghoulish watch. If the race hadn't been a flop, win or lose, he would have been guzzling champagne in celebration with the other racers and a coterie of lovely women who hovered around the race circuit like beautiful butterflies. A respectable number of bottles were popped, but the festivities had been dampened for Kurt and Ali and their crews. Ali showed up with an Italian model on one arm and a French mademoiselle on the other. Even so, he didn't look particularly happy. Austin elicited a smile when he told the Arab he looked forward to competing against him again soon. Zavala upheld his reputation as a ladies' man by carving a chestnut-haired beauty from the field of groupies on hand for the race finale. They were going out for dinner, where Zavala promised to regale his date with the details of his narrow escape. Austin stayed long enough to be polite, then left the party to phone the owner of the Red Ink. Austin's father was expecting his call. He had watched the race finale on TV and knew Austin was safe, and the boat lay at the bottom of the ocean. The elder Austin was the wealthy owner of a marine salvage company based in Seattle.
"Don't worry about it," he said. "We'll build another one, even better. Maybe with a periscope next time."
Chuckling evilly, he recounted in loving and unnecessary detail the night a teenage Austin had brought his father's Mustang convertible home with a crumpled fender. Most Grand Prix races were held in and around Europe, but Austin's father wanted an American-built boat to win in American waters. He paid for the design and construction of a fast new boat he called the Red Ink because of the money it cost him, and put together a top-notch pit crew and support team. His father put it with his typical bluntness.
"Time we kick ass. We're going to build a boat that shows these guys that we can win with American parts, American know-how, and an American driver. You."
Formed a conglomerate of sponsors and used their economic clout to bring a major race to the States. Race promoters were eager for the opportunity to tap into the vast potential of the American audience, and before long the first SoCal Grand Prix had become a reality. NUMA director Admiral James Sandecker grumbled when Austin told him he wanted to work around assignments, whenever possible, so he could race in the qualifying runs. Sandecker said he was worried about Austin being injured in a race. Austin had politely pointed out that for all its dangers, racing was a canoe paddle compared with the hazardous job Sandecker assigned him to as leader of NUMA's special assignments team. As a trump card, he played on the Admiral's fierce patriotic pride. Sandecker gave Austin his blessing and said it was about time the United States showed the rest of the world that they could compete with the best of them. Austin returned to the party after talking to his father. He quickly tired of the false hilarity and was happy to be invited aboard the Nepenthe to meet Gloria Eckhart, who wanted to thank him. The actress's mature warmth and beauty enchanted him. When they shook hands, she didn't let go right away. They talked a while and maintained eye contact that sent messages of mutual interest. Austin briefly entertained the fantasy of having a fling with someone he'd idolized on the big and little screens. It was not to be. Apologizing profusely, Eckhart was dragged off by the demands of her children. Figuring it just wasn't his day, Austin went back to the hotel and answered calls from NUMA colleagues and friends. He had dinner sent up and enjoyed filet mignon as he watched TV reruns of the race. The stations were running slow-motion replays again and again. Austin was more interested in the fate of the dead whales. One reporter mentioned that three whales were going to be examined at the naval station. Austin was curious as well as bored. From what he had heard and seen, the whales didn't have a mark to indicate what killed them. The incompleteness of the situation went beyond the loss of his father's boat. It rankled his sense of orderliness. The autopsy seemed to be winding down. Austin asked the seaman to take his NUMA business card to someone in charge. The seaman returned with a sandy-haired man in his 40s, who stripped off his blood-soaked foul-weather gear and gloves, but kept his surgical mask on.
"Mr. Austin," he said, extending his hand. "Jason Witherell, EPA. Pleasure to meet you. Glad to have NUMA interested. We might need to utilize your resources."
"We're always ready to help the EPA," Austin said. "My interest is more personal than official. I was in the race today when the whales made their appearance."
"I saw the news clips." Witherell laughed. "That was one hell of a maneuver you pulled off. Sorry about your boat."
"Thanks. I was wondering, have you come up with a cause of death?"
"Sure. They died of dork."
"Pardon?"
Witherell grinned. "Don't really know. Dork."
Austin smiled patiently. He knew pathologists sometimes cultivated a zany sense of humor to help maintain their sanity.
"Any guesses?"
Witherell said,
As far as we can determine for now, there was no evidence of trauma or toxin, and we've tested tissue for virus. Negative so far. One whale had become entangled in a monofilament fishing net, but it doesn't seem to have prevented the animal from eating or harmed it in any fatal way.
So, at least for now, you don't have a clue how they died?
Oh, sure, we know how. They suffocated. There was heavy lung damage that caused pneumonia. The lungs seem to have been damaged by intense heat.
Heat? I'm not sure I follow you.
I'll put it this way. They were partially cooked internally, and their skin was blistered as well.
What could have done something like that?
Dork, Witherell said with a shrug of his shoulders. Austin pondered the answer.
If you don't know what, how about when?
Well, that's tough to pinpoint. The initial exposure might not have been instantly fatal. The mammals could have become ill several days before their deaths, but continued to make their way along the coast. The little ones would have been the sickest, and maybe the adults waited for them. You'd have to factor in the time it would take for the body to decompose and for the putrefaction gases to bloat them up where they'd surface in the race course. So if you backtracked, you might be able to determine where they were when they died. You'd have to consider traveling and feeding time and currents, of course.
He shook his head.
Too bad the whales can't tell us where they've been.
Witherell chuckled.
Who says they can't tell us? Come on, I'll show you. The EPA man led the way past the flatbeds around the puddles of bloody water being hosed into drains. The smell was like a sledgehammer this close to the dead whales, but Witherell didn't seem to be bothered.
Well, this is the male, he said, stopping by the first carcass.
You can see why they're called gray whales. The skin is naturally dark, but it's blotched from barnacle scars and whale lice. He's a bit chopped up now. When we first measured him, he was 41 feet. They walked to the next flatbed, which held a miniaturized version of the first whale. This calf is also a male, born just a few months ago. There were other calves, so we don't know if it belonged to the female. They had paused before the last flatbed. She's bigger than the male. Like the others, she's got no outward signs of any bruise or laceration that might be fatal. This is what might interest you. He borrowed a knife from a colleague, climbed onto the flatbed, and bent over the whale's fin. After a minute, he hopped down and handed Austin a flat, square packet of metal and plastic.
A transponder, Austin said.
Witherell pointed up. This old girl's every move was being tracked by satellite. Find out who's been keeping an eye on her, and that person should be able to tell you where she has been and when.
You're a genius, Mr. Witherell.
Only a humble government servant like you trying to do my job. He hefted the transponder. I'll have to hold on to this thing, but there's a number to call on the back. Austin jotted the number down in a small notebook and thanked the pathologist for his help. As Witherell escorted him back to the door, Austin said,
"By the way, how'd you choose these particular whales?"
"It was done pretty much by chance. I asked the Navy to cut 3 representative animals out of the batch. I guess there was somebody on board who actually listened to my request."
"Do you think you would have been more likely to find a cause of death if you had a chance to autopsy the other corpses?"
"I doubt it," Witherell said flatly. "What killed these whales killed the others that were towed away. It's a bit late for that, anyhow. From what I understand, after the Navy got through with them, there wasn't enough left of the other animals for a plate of sushi."
More autopsy humor.
Tossing his surgical mask into a barrel, Austin took a last look at the butchered carcasses that were the sad remains of once magnificent sea creatures. He thanked Witherell and Seaman Cummings and stepped out into the fresh night air. He gulped in several deep breaths, as if he could purge his memory as well as his lungs of the rank smell. Across the harbor sparkled the city-like lights of an aircraft carrier. He drove back to the hotel and walked quickly through the lobby, but not fast enough to avoid a few nose wrinkles from the staff and guests who had picked up the stench of death. Back in his room, Austin threw the khakis and dress shirt he'd been wearing into a laundry bag. He took a long hot shower, shampooed twice, and changed into slacks and a golf shirt. Then he settled into a comfortable chair, picked up the phone, and dialed the number marked on the transponder. As he expected, he was connected to voicemail. The government wouldn't pay someone to sit around and wait for news of a meandering whale. It might take days before someone answered his call. He left no message and instead called a 24-hour desk at NUMA headquarters outside Washington and put in a request. The phone rang about a half hour later. "Mr. Austin, my name is Wanda Pirelli. I'm with the Interior Department. Someone called from NUMA and said you were looking for me. They said it was important."
"Yes, thanks for calling. I'm sorry to bother you at home. You heard about the gray whales off California?"
"Oh, yes. I was wondering how you got my number."
"It was on a transponder attached to the fin of a female whale."
"Oh, dear, that was Daisy. It was her pod. I've been tracking her for 3 years. She's almost like a relative."
"I'm sorry to hear that. There were 14 whales in all. She was one of those picked at random."
She sighed loudly. "Oh, this is terrible news. We've tried so hard to protect the grays, and they've really been making a comeback. We're waiting for a forensics report on cause of death."
"I came from the necropsy a little while ago. Apparently there was no sign of a virus or pollutant. The whales died from lung damage caused by intense heat. Have you ever heard of such a thing happening?"
"No, never."
"Does anyone know the source of this heat?"
"Not yet. I thought it might shed some light on the incident if we knew where the whales had been recently."
"I'm pretty familiar with Daisy's pod. Their migration is really quite remarkable. They make a 10,000-mile round trip. They feed all summer in the Arctic seas, then head south along the Pacific coast to the breeding lagoons in Baja California, Mexico. They start moving around November and December and get there early the following year. The pregnant females lead the way, then the mature adults and the juveniles, in single file or in pairs. They go pretty close to the shoreline. They start back north in March. The whales with calves may wait until April. Again, they follow the coastline closely on the way north. They go real slow, about 10 miles an hour on the average.
There was a briefing before the boat race. We were told to keep a watch for whales, but the race had been scheduled after the last pod had passed. As far as anyone knew, there were no whales in the vicinity.
The only thing I can think of is that they were stragglers. Maybe one of the calves became sick and they dallied somewhere until the calves were well."
The pathologist had the same theory. "Would you have kept track of their migration?"
"Yes."
"Do you have access to a laptop computer?"
"Wouldn't be without it."
"Good. Give me your email address. I'll tap into the database and get the information to you at light speed."
"Thank you. Can't ask for better service than that."
"You might get the chance to pay me back if we call on NUMA for help."
"Call me personally, and we'll do what we can."
"Thanks. Oh, God, I still can't believe it about Daisy."
Austin hung up, opened his IBM laptop computer, and hooked it up to the telephone. After 15 minutes passed, he opened his email file. A map of the western U.S., Canada, and Alaska appeared. A dotted line ran down from the Chukchi Sea, through the Bering Sea, then along the coast of North America to the tip of the finger-like Baja Peninsula. The map was labeled General Whale Migration Route. Attached to the map was specific information on actual pods. Austin scrolled down until he found the file name Daisy. The file linked to a map showing the exact route of the Daisy pod. The pod had made steady progress, then had stopped off the Baja coast south of Tijuana.
After a pause, they started north again, moving slower than before. At one point, they looped around as if they were disoriented. He followed their tortuous path until it stopped off San Diego. Austin exited the whale file and called up several other sites. After a few minutes, he sat back in his chair and tapped his fingertips together. The whales were migrating normally until they reached a certain area. Then something changed. He was pondering what he should do when he heard somebody at the door. Zavala.
Home from your date so soon?
Yeah, I told her I had to get back to check on my sick roommate.
Austin looked alarmed. You didn't bump your head today, did you?
I must admit, going under a boat was a unique experience. I'll never look at the nautical rules of the road in the same light again.
Well, for your information, I feel fine, so you can go back and pick up where you left off.
Zavala flopped down onto the sofa.
You know something, Kurt, there are times when one has to show some restraint.
Austin wondered if a Zavala clone, stripped of its sexual drive, had walked into the room.
I agree wholeheartedly, he said with caution. Now tell me the real reason.
She broke Zavala's rule. I don't go out with married women.
How did you know she was married?
Her husband told me so.
Oh. Was he big?
Slightly smaller than a cement truck. Well, restraint was an especially wise decision in that case.
Joe nodded, unconvinced. God, she was beautiful, he said with a sigh.
What have you been up to?
I went to a whale necropsy.
And I thought I was having a bad time. There must be more fun things to do in San Diego.
I'm sure there are, but I was curious about what killed those whales.
Did they find the cause?
Their lungs were damaged by heat, and they died of pneumonia.
Strange, Zavala said.
I thought so.
Look at this map on my computer. I got it through a NOAA weather satellite. It shows the water temperature of the ocean. See that little red bump in the water off the Baja? Sudden temperature change.
You're saying our whales became sick shortly after they passed this area of warm temperature?
Maybe. But I'm more interested in what caused that change.
I think you're about to suggest a trip south of the border.
I could use an interpreter. Paul and Gamay won't be back in Arlington for a few days.
No problemo. It's important for me to stay in touch with my Mexican roots.
He got up and started for the door.
Where are you going? Austin said.
Zavala looked at the clock.
The night is young. Two devilishly handsome and eligible bachelors sitting in their room talking about dead whales and hot water. Not healthy, amigo. I saw a beautiful woman in the lounge as I passed by. She looks as if she could use company.
I thought you were giving women up.
A momentary delusion caused by my injuries. Besides, I think she had a friend, Zavala said. And there's a good jazz band playing in the lounge.
Austin's appreciation for cool jazz came right after his love of beautiful women and fast boats. A tequila and lime juice nightcap would taste mighty good. To say nothing about female companionship. He grinned and closed the cover on his laptop computer.